That's a really good question.
But one that doesn't have an easy answer.
Yeah.
Well,
not an answer I've come up with yet.
Not a big class today. So that's what we decided about the exam and help. Questions? So that exam had 7 questions, so same story as last time. I mean, it's a shorter time, so there'll be 4 questions on your exam. I haven't made up the exam, so I don't really know kind of what it's going to have. It'll certainly have something like Clebsch-Gordan stuff on it, right? I don't know if I would say that's the most important stuff, but it's the most testable stuff.
When you say Clebsch-Gordan, you mean raising and lowering?
So all of these things are related. So I guess
or,
I would.
Sorry, you mean these guys?
So those are Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So I think if you were to look at the old exam, you'd see that the problem that was there that was Clebsch-Gordan-ish was where I gave you a combination wave function and asked you to show that it was an eigenfunction of total angular momentum squared. But I know questions that ask you to use the table would be fair game. Raising and lowering operators are always good questions by themselves. Spin operators. I mean, the one thing that we have done a lot of and is very important is solving different Hamiltonians, right? Solving the H atom. And I can remember when I was forced to memorize that so I could regurgitate it in 10 minutes on an exam. But I guess I'm not sure I see a real point to that. But those are all, I mean, that was the most important thing we did was solving square well and hydrogen atom and two-dimensional harmonic oscillator, all of those things in proper fashion. We have the results, but the method is good, but difficult to do in 10 minutes. Questions?
I have one. I think it pops up in 2 different homework problems, but you take the absolute value, I think, of the psi function, and then you ask us why the nodes disappear in one of the axes. I think one is the azimuthal nodes all disappear, and then another one is I don't know. We see this. We have the radial plot of the nodes, and then there's no separation. I guess I don't know. You asked us to say like why that's happening, and I have no idea.
Well, of course, I hope the mathematics of it is clear. That is to say, if we were go back to just one dimension, e to the I kx, I would say that has oscillation in it because it has sines and cosines for the real and imaginary part. But the magnitude of this, right? If I take this and multiply by its complex conjugate, I'll get e to the plus I times e to the minus I, and they'll cancel out.
So, I mean, is that all we have to make the argument for?
That's all that I was looking for. So in the particular case that you're talking about, these are e to the I m phis, and so they have oscillation in the phi direction, but the magnitude doesn't have oscillation. Yeah, I wasn't looking for a deep reason because there really isn't a deep reason. That is to say, I mean, when I wrote e to the I kx, just as good a function as that, right? It's also an eigenfunction, and it does then have real nodes and all of the rest. So it's kind of a choice that we take these e to the I m phis. And if you're going to go talk to a chemist, chemists don't know anything about complex numbers, so they don't choose to use e to the I m phi. They choose to use sines and cosines. And they're not terrible reasons for doing it that way. But. They are just as good, right? You can linear combinations of e to the plus im phi and e to the minus im phi and linear combinations of sine m phi and cosine m phi give you exactly the same set of functions. The nice thing about these wave functions is that they are eigenfunctions of Lz, whereas if we just have sine or cosine, those aren't eigenfunctions of Lz. And same thing with e to the ikz. E to the ikz is an eigenfunction of momentum, whereas sine kx isn't an eigenfunction of momentum. But they both satisfy Schrodinger's equation. More questions? So I would say a lot of the homework that you all have been turning in so much of isn't that hard, right? There's a fair amount of it that is just Mathematica stuff, whose point is often to realize that there are r squared drs and things like that that you need to think about, which have in the past been common problems on exams. People will normalize something and forget that there's an r squared dr. More questions? Well, last time could have been from mechanics, except you hadn't done E&M yet, so couldn't have done that in mechanics. And what we wanted to see is how we could get the 200 formula that we've known for the force on charged particles in a magnetic field, B cross B, how we could get that into our Hamiltonian. And it's not obvious because there is a potential energy for the electric field, but there isn't a potential energy for the magnetic field. And we go through the process step by step, and this is what we get for our Hamiltonian. And what will be a difficult idea to break is when you see P not thinking MV, but it's not anymore. P is not the mechanical momentum, it's the canonical momentum. And the canonical momentum doesn't have to equal the mechanical momentum. In particular, in this problem, there is going to be electromagnetic momentum, which basically has to be added in. So this thing with the minus sign is the mechanical momentum. And so that quantity squared is basically the velocity squared. So that is kinetic energy plus potential energy. It just looks kind of funny. So once we've got the classical Hamiltonian, all we do is replace the P by h bar over I grad and then solve the resulting Schrodinger equation. So this form, as I said at the time, is kind of pregnant for Nobel Prizes. All we have to do to solve what were super outstanding problems circa 1960, that is to say, what is the nature of the weak force, what is the nature of the strong force, all you have to do is generalize this. The weak and the strong force look a whole lot like electricity and magnetism. They're all gauge forces. And it does take a certain amount of cleverness, and those Nobel Prizes were well deserved. It wasn't trivial to do this, but I don't know if it's surprising or not surprising, but 15 years after all of this stuff was sitting there as a plum waiting to be pulled off, I was told that all of this quark stuff was going to, by my particle physics teacher, that well-respected experimental particle physicist, that all of this quark stuff was probably going to disappear. Other things were on the agenda in the 60s. And it was before my time, so I guess I don't know why. But people were viciously barking up the wrong tree, except for a handful of people. So that's E&M, that's the weak force, that's the strong force. Who knows how gravity works, but it doesn't work like this as far as we can figure out. It looks to be some sort of gauge force, but some new trick is required. As you know, string theory has been, for the last 30 years, the thing that was going to give us that answer. And traditionally in physics, people make fun of plasma physics because they're always promising more than they deliver. They've been promising controlled fusion for 60 years. Well, the string theory people have been promising results next year for the last 30 years. And they deserve to be the butt of some jokes now, I guess I would say. Still might be right, but 30 years is a long time with no success. And at least the plasma people have had continual minor successes. And at this point, it will be. This time it will be true that in the next 10 years, we will have reached scientific break-even with plasma physics. I'm convinced. Okay, so going along with this Hamiltonian is gauge transformations, which in E&M, I tried to convince you was super important, although it doesn't seem to be super important. It goes along with this generalized idea of all the other forces work. But the only thing that's really important are the fields, and the fields are based on potentials. And if we make this sort of transformation to the potentials, we don't change what the fields are. So it can't fundamentally change what the problem is. So it turns out if we just have this phase factor that we multiply by our psi with, this new psi and these new potentials put into the Hamiltonian will work just as well. So a gauge transformation as far as the wave function is concerned is just a phase factor. It is a phase factor that in general will depend on position, right? It's pretty trivial if F were a constant, but typically F is going to depend on position. And so it's going to be a space-dependent phase factor, but it all comes out in the wash. Okay, so we wanted to fire up an example of magnetic fields, and there's probably no simpler example than cyclotron motion. So no electric field, just a magnetic field, and you learned in 200 that particles just go around in circles. They would move in the direction, there's no force in the z direction, so they would happily have some constant momentum in the z direction, but they have this circular motion clockwise if they're positively charged. And everything I'm doing here is assuming positive charge, which is the opposite of what you would probably do experimentally. You'd probably be using electrons. So one of the things that, for me at least, is always confusing is we have two different frequencies that are similar but different and then similar again. So we have the cyclotron frequency, which is the frequency of this orbital motion, and we have the Larmor frequency, which is the frequency that a spin would precess in a magnetic field, and they just differ by factors of two. But then you might remember that electrons actually have a gyromagnetic ratio that's twice as big, approximately twice as big as you would expect classically. So then the Larmor frequency and the cyclotron frequency become more or less the same. So plenty of sources of confusion there. But we do get to use, well, at least one dead physicist's name and one important machine's name. So that's always a benefit. This is a particular choice of gauge which gives us a constant magnetic field in the z direction. There are lots of such choices. This is the one that's kind of symmetric in terms of x and y. And it also has the property that the divergence of A is zero. That's not required, but it means that the P and the A commute with each other. And so you can just treat them as algebra. And with a little bit of work, you get this Hamiltonian. The classical gyromagnetic ratio comes out for free, and then it's off to the races. So when we square A, we get quadratic terms. Here we have LZ because B is in the magnetic field direction. In the Z direction, we can have constant speed motion, so we have that term. So we have simple harmonic oscillator plus an angular momentum term. And we solved the simple harmonic oscillator with in units that had constant angular momentum. So We've got a solution to this. And it's, there's the energy. It's just sitting there. And what is true is that the omega that we have in that Hamiltonian is the Larmor omega. But we end up with factors of 2. So the resulting separation between these levels is the cyclotron frequency. And you might remember that the separation of levels basically is related to the classical frequency. So even though Larmor went into the mix, cyclotron came out, which is good. We have an infinite degeneracy, which is also good because you could have the cyclotron motion any place in the XY plane, little circles any place, so we ought to have an infinite number of these sorts of solutions. Questions? Okay, well, I don't know if there are two N's in Zeeman or not. So Zeeman is a Dutch physicist who was fired for winning a Nobel Prize, essentially. So as a somewhat lowly lab assistant, he was told not to look at how the energy levels of atoms changed in strong magnetic fields, but he did it anyway. He was fired. 5 years later, he won the Nobel Prize for that work. And of course, he then got a full-time position. And it's not too tricky, right? The Hamiltonian we have for this problem is going to be the same Hamiltonian we have for just the hydrogen atom by itself. We know that we should really use the reduced mass, but I'll use that. And then we've got the, we'll write it out this way. We've got the electrostatic attraction for our voltage. If we have a uniform magnetic field in the z direction, we're going to get this exact same term. And I guess I'll write it as plus because the charge of an electron is minus q. And then we have quadratic terms. And what we're going to do is to neglect these terms for the time being. And that can be justified. So they really are there. And if you go to, this thing is all multiplied by b squared. So if you go to large enough magnetic fields, those terms will not be small. But then somebody else's name goes on the Nobel Prize who studied those very large magnetic field cases. Now these things are electrons, and so we have another term in this Hamiltonian. This was the minimal electromagnetic coupling. You know that there's potential energy that is minus mu dot b for a magnetic dipole moment, and we've got a spinning electron. So the spinning electron has a mu that is the gyromagnetic ratio. And then for some reason, it's about a factor of 2 bigger than we would expect classically. So the upshot is that we've got a Hamiltonian that is E over 2 MB LZ plus 2 SC. Not exactly 2, something like that. Close enough to 2, and we're trying to solve that sort of problem. Okay, so there are a couple of features of this problem that are useful to think about, and the first one is we have an adjustable parameter. That is to say, in the lab, we can make the magnetic field anything we want. And so we can look at how a energy level depends on the magnetic field. Right, so we can see that this energy level goes up or it goes down, all as a function of that magnetic field. Now, in the particular case of the hydrogen atom, this energy level is highly degenerate, right? N squared different possibilities. So out of this one energy level, we can get lots of different levels that diverge with at various rates according to the corresponding magnetic field. And of course, this is also going to be true of the level they go to. So if we pick a particular magnetic field, we might have transitions, say, kind of like that, from one level to another. And what's going to be very important is the selection rules for those sorts of transitions. And it turns out, well, let's think about a particularly simple case. If this thing had orbital angular momentum L, then there would be 2L plus 1 possibilities, with the m value going from plus L to minus L, various m values. Then it turns out that the selection rule is that the change in m is either plus minus 1 or 0. So we can have a transition like this. We can have a transition like that. We can have a transition like that. But we can't have a transition like that. Okay, so a couple of important features here. Adjustable perturbation with a parameter that we have under our control, namely the magnetic field, and some sort of selection rule that's going to select among all of these various transitions, which ones are in fact going to be possible. And the selection rule also predicts the polarization of the light that comes out under these various circumstances. And the story is that Zeeman detected this result and he presented it to Lorentz, and the next day Lorentz had a nice classical explanation for it. Incidentally, we're talking about, I don't know, something like, you know, 1895-ish. Something like that for this effect. So before quantum mechanics. There's a similar sort of obvious thing to do, and that's to put an electric field. Right, a very similar sort of situation where we have an adjustable parameter. We can change the electric field and see how these levels change as a result. And Stark is the name that's associated with that. And it was done substantially later, but still before the sort of quantum mechanics we're talking about. So it was done in the time frame of what's called old quantum mechanics, Bohr's quantum mechanics, as opposed to Heisenberg's quantum mechanics. And turns out that Stark effect is more difficult to describe. We'll do it eventually. And nobody much likes Stark. Stark was a Nazi. So famously, Stark and Lenard wrote books about Jewish physics, which was a negative term. So Einstein and, you know, was kind of a quasi-Jew, and Heisenberg, who was not a Jew, they were responsible for this deviant form of physics where theory predominated over common sense. And obviously, Stark thought that common sense was correct. So he's not a favorite. Stark and Lenard, not good guys. The Dutch, of course, Zeeman, Lorentz, those are good guys. Okay, so off to the races. So you should have this piece of paper, which which describes these sorts of levels. Here's kind of the way this would work experimentally, optically. So we would see, this would be as a function of frequency, right? So think about using a diffraction grating to look at light. Instead of seeing just one line, we see that line break up into lots of different levels. And so that's the phenomena that wants to be explained. Now one of the thing...
How would you get light out of this scenario? You're doing just transitions?
It's transitions, right? So if we have a change in energy, it's going to come out somehow. It'll come out as a photon. Are we happy with that or not? So like one of the, so you know about the famous sodium D lines, right? Or maybe not. A pair of close together lines in the yellow that make sodium lights look yellow. I think one of these is the sodium D line. It's kind of, yeah, the bottom. So one of the things that I was certainly confused about as an undergrad, and maybe as a grad student, is kind of this nomenclature, the normal Zeeman effect and the anomalous Zeeman effect. So in the normal Zeeman effect, all of these levels go up and down by exactly the same amount. And so we only get three different, the single line will split into three lines depending upon whether the change in M was plus one, zero, or minus one. And it turns out that the normal Zeeman effect basically never happens. The normal Zeeman effect is only observed when we have singlet states. And you remember that Hund's rule says that maximum spin is kind of the normal case. So things like lithium and calcium, those guys, I think, have ground states that are singlets. But most states are not singlets. And so the vast majority of atoms follow the anomalous Zeeman effect. So I don't know, at least in my modern physics book, the Zeeman effect was kind of presented, as it was seen at the time, I think, as a great confirmation of theory. But boy, you had to pick and choose your examples of great confirmation of theory when 90% of the elements don't show the normal Zeeman effect. They show a more complicated effect where we get large numbers of lines. Incidentally, the little pi's and sigmas indicate the polarization of the resulting line, which is also predicted by the theory. Okay, so let's make a calculation of the anomalous Zeeman effect and see kind of why it's anomalous and exactly how that comes about. And the short answer to all of this is that the slope of these lines, that is to say how these lines change with magnetic field, is going to be different for different levels. And so as a result, not only is it going to depend what delta M is, but it's also going to depend on kind of which level you went between. Right, so if you look at the pictures, you now see that here we have a big shift compared to here where we have a smaller shift. And so as a result, these different transitions give, every one gives different energies. And here we have even a smaller shift compared to the ground state, and so we end up getting four states. So this, the usual, I mean, normal often means usual, right? And it doesn't mean normal in this case. What it means is, confirming theory circa 1900. And of course, theory circa 1900 was wrong. Okay, so let's do the longish calculation that's required to calculate the Zeeman effect in hydrogen, or equivalently, whatever was it, sodium or potassium, that we have for the, I guess it's sodium, So the main thing that we're going to need in what we're talking about is we're going to have a ground state that consists of a single s electron, and we're going to have excited states which consists of s electrons. Right, so we can take, if this is hydrogen, we can take our 1s electron and put it in a 2s or a 2p. So the ground state has total angular momentum 0, so we're going to give it a nomenclature capital S. And it, the only thing it has is 1 spin 1 half, so this is going to be doublet S. And if we take 0 angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, and add it to spin angular momentum 1 half, we get a J value that is 1 half. For these P values, we have a total orbital angular momentum that is 1, so that's going to be a P. We have a total, still have a total spin angular momentum that is 2. When, in terms of the J level, we have spin 1 half added to 1, so we can get 3 halves, or we can get P halves. We can get 1 half. And we expect the lower energy state is going to be the 1 half state. This S works exactly like that S, right? It's going to be doublet S. So what we know is that the this perturbation that we're talking about, and I'll go back to writing this as minus Q, and I can pull out of this total angular momentum Z plus S. And the eigenfunctions that we make up, of course, have a definite value of total angular momentum. Right? So this guy is going to give us H bar MJ. So really what we're going to need to find out is what is the expectation value of the spin in the Z direction for each one of these levels. Then we need to add that to H bar MJ, and we're going to end up then figuring out what that full perturbation is. Does that make sense? So again, what we've done and what we do in general is we take orbital angular momentum and add it to spin angular momentum to get total angular momentum. So the state, we're going to use our Clebsch-Gordan table to do that. And then we're going to want to calculate the expectation value of the spin in order to calculate this final result. Okay, so what are these states? So in this case, we have spin 1 half and orbital angular momentum 1. So 1 half plus 1 is going to give us total angular momentums of 3 halves. So the 3 halves levels, of course, are going to have m values that are going to range from 3 halves, 1 half, minus 1 half, and minus 3 halves. All of these have total angular momentum 3 halves. And this guy here, we're going to have two states which have z component of angular momentum that's either 1 half or minus 1 half. Okay, so this state here, I hope it's pretty clear what it's going to be, right? We're going to have the spatial state, a p state. I'm just going to write p for it. And then we have to have the spin up. Right? So we need to have the P level with its M value 1 and spin up in order to make a state that has Z component that is 3 halves. And how that fits into this table is if we, So if we have, so here we're taking things. Orbital angular momentum one and combining it with spin 1/2. And if we want to make a state that has total angular momentum 3/2 and has a z component that is 3/2, there's only one state that's going to work, and it has ML equal to 1 and it has MS equal to 1/2. Okay? So that, I hope that one is easier. Same state, but oriented in a different direction, it's going to have coefficients that are the square root of 1/3 and the square root of 3/2. So here, this thing is going to be, I can't simultaneously read that table from this distance, so hopefully it's right in my notes. That is going to be the square root of 1/3 of one unit of angular momentum with spin down, plus the square root of 2/3 zero angular momentum and spin up. Right? So we see that? So one and down 1/3, sideways and up 2/3. Hopefully that's what I wrote over there. Okay, same state, now oriented a little bit down. It's going to be the square root of 2/3 zero and down, plus the square root of 1/3 minus 1 and up. Right, so this is this guy here, total angular momentum 3/2, oriented slightly down, zero down being 2/3 and minus 1 up being 1/3. Okay, and finally we have this state here, which there's only one way to make it, right? Minus 1 and down. Everyone believes that? Okay. So now we want to have the state that has total angular momentum 1/2 and that angular momentum is oriented up. That's this guy here. So that is 2/3 minus 1/3. Hopefully that corresponds to what I wrote down here. Yep, and the other one, square root of 1/3, zero and down, minus the square root of 2/3, minus 1 and up. Okay, so now we want to calculate the expectation value of the spin in the z direction for all of these states. I'm going to leave off the h bar, right? But everything would be multiplied by h bar. So if I take 3/2, 3/2, put in the spin z operator, well, the only thing that depends on spin is this, and it's going to give me a 1/2, right? Maybe not so 1. So when the spin operator operates on the spatial state, it doesn't care, right? Totally different coordinates. When it operates on spin up, it's going to give us 1/2 times spin up. And then everything is orthogonal, so the 1 and the spin up on this side are just going to give us 1s when we do the integration. Let's do the next one because it's substantially trickier. So what I've got here, and let me write it all out. So I've got the square root of 2/3, zero and down, plus the square root of 1/3, minus 1 and up, the spin operator, and then I've got the same thing. So far, so good. So if the spin operator operates on this one here, which is spin down, it's going to give me, this coefficient is just going to go along for the ride, and doesn't care about the spatial state, it's going to give us minus 1/2 times that same function. That is to say, spin up and spin down are eigenfunctions of the SC with eigenvalues of either plus minus 1/2. This one here doesn't care about the spatial state, but it's going to give us 1/2 times spin up. So now I have an integral to do, right? And it's going to have four terms. So if I do this, the spatial state, it's the same state, and those are normalized. So when I do this integral, I get 1. When I do that integral, I get 1. We believe that?
The integral is 1, what you're saying?
Yeah, so these are normalized states. If you want, you can take kind of the Book's idea that this thing is 0, 1. So what I have is 0, 1, daggered 0, 1, and you just do it and you're going to get 1. Or you can think about those as being dependent upon these ugly internal coordinates, which we never write down, but they're normalized. Okay, so from these two guys, I'm going to get this guy squared 2/3 of minus 1/2. What is this thing?
Zero.
Zero, right? Doubly zero, right? This and this are different eigenfunctions. They're going to be orthogonal. This and this are different eigenfunctions. They're going to be orthogonal. Same thing with these two guys, right? They're going to give us zero. So what I'm going to get for the other state is going to be 2/3 times, minus 2/3. That minus 1. Yes, that minus 1 doesn't have anything to do with minus, right? It's just a state label. So I have 1/3 times 1/2. Okay, so minus 1/3 plus 1/6. Boy, I'm not sure I'm happy with that answer. I think I wanted that to be plus 1/6.
So,
the sixth is plus.
All the total answer, I think.
Yeah. So I have. I see. I skipped over this one, right? That's the one I thought I was doing. But I'm in fact doing the other one, and that one I do want to get minus 1/6 for. And if I do this one, I get plus 1/6.
That's the one right above, right there.
Yeah, so that's this one here. And if I do this one here, the only spin is spin down, so I'm going to get minus 1/2. So now I'm going to do something that is not going to seem particularly useful. I'm going to factor out an m that isn't there. Okay, so I'm going to write this 1/2 as 3/2 times 1/3. Right? I can do that, and I'm picking this to be the m value that I have for that state. And the reason I'm doing that is the other term has an m value in it too. So then kind of overall, I'm going to factor these things out. So 1/6 is 1/3 of 1/2. And minus 1/6 is 1/3 of the corresponding m value, which is minus 1/2. And minus 1/2 is 1/3 the corresponding m value, which is minus 3/2. So for all of these states, the expectation value of the spin is 1/3 the m value. Okay, so at this point you may be wondering why a constant value could be pulled out of those three distinct integrals. And what I'm going to tell you is it always works, and I'm not going to tell you why. At least maybe I might mention some dead physicists' names as to why. Okay, so how about for these P states? So for this P state, I'm going to, so I hope, well, do we need to write all this out or can we do them in our heads? One more completely or? So for this term here, the only contribution is going to come from the corresponding term over there, right?
Yes.
So I'm going to get 2/3, and this is going to be spin that is minus a half. For this term here, I have a minus sign, but I have a minus sign on the other term too, so they're still going to come together to give me a plus. And the spin here is 1/2. So now I've got minus a third, plus a sixth, which is minus the sixth. And if I factor out the corresponding m value, it's minus a third times the corresponding m value, which is plus a half. If we do this one, we're going to have 1/3 of minus a half from this term here, plus 2/3 of plus a half. So minus a sixth plus the third is plus a sixth, and it's still minus 1/3 times the m value. So for all of these states, it's minus 1/3 times the m value. How about for all of these S states? Well, so the S states are easy, right? Because they only have one angular momentum and one spin. So these things are just going to give us, according to whether they're spin up or spin down, they're just going to give us the corresponding value of spin. So it's going to be 1 times mj. Okay, same thing here. So the upshot then is this quantity, it's always going to be times m, and we have 1 for this guy, and we either have plus 1/3 or minus 1/3 according to whether we're in this state or that state. For these S states, it's always going to be 1 plus 1. Okay, so if you look at this neato diagram, what we see is that the biggest splitting comes in the ground state, right? The doublet S 1/2. Where this coefficient is 2. The next biggest splitting comes from the doublet P 3/2, where this constant is 4/3. And the smallest splitting comes from this guy here, where that constant is just going to be 1/3. And if you look, I don't know, if you look carefully, you might notice that these guys look to be about half of those guys. And if you add up a splitting from both of those, you pretty much get that splitting, right? So it's even been done more or less correctly.
So in their notation, what is that m dot g?
Where's their m dot g?
It's like the one third, maybe the one third they list for the p one half.
So, yeah, I think that's the m value times the g factor.
And the g factor is what we were kind of coming up with.
And the g factor is what's in those parentheses.
Okay.
And, I mean, once you know what's in parentheses, then this whole story is easy, right? So the main point of the anomalous Zeeman effect is g depends on what orbit you're in. And because it depends on what orbit you're in, then different transitions give you different energies. So we get multiple lines as opposed to different transitions giving you the same energy when we just get the three lines, the unusual normal Zeeman effect. Okay, so how about some famous dead physicists? Wigner Eckert. So the Wigner-Eckert theorem explains lots, including why we always get something that's proportional to m in this particular case. And I'm never going to mention, we're never going to know what the Wigner-Eckert theorem says. Just know that those are famous guys, right? So I've met Wigner. He was alive when I was alive. And I guess the other thing I want to talk about is kind of the semi-classical approach. So to me, it's somewhat incredible, but it's the approach that our book takes, and that is to argue that the average value of S can be calculated by the following kind of trick. S dot J in the J direction divided by J squared. So the argument is that these vectors are processing around. And so the only thing that really matters is how much of the S vector is in the J direction way. Because as the J direction processes, you're going to get a corresponding fraction of it. This does explain why everything just depends on the M value of J as a multiplicative factor. But I don't know, it's a big thing to swallow. That those things are the same. It's true, and one can prove it, but Griffiths doesn't provide a proof, and the proof is complicated, and basically a better approach would be to prove the Wigner-Eckert theorem if you really wanted to understand that. How about the Zeeman effect? Oops, the Stark effect. If we adopted the same sort of approach, what we should be thinking about, so I'm thinking about the electric field, the voltage being minus E naught times Z, just like it was last semester. So what I should be asking about is, what is the average value of Z for the hydrogen wave functions? And the answer is zero, right? They're as much up as they are down. So that kind of suggests that the splitting should not be proportional to E. Maybe it's proportional to E squared. But it's not. The splitting is proportional to E. So there's something tricky going on in the Stark effect, which is why it's not in the beginning of the chapter, it's in the end of the chapter. And it takes a special sort of perturbation theory in order to handle the Stark effect, the degenerate Stark effect. And I should also say maybe some words that I pointed a little bit at, and that is that it starts out that these energy levels go linearly with B, but there really is that quadratic term. So that at large enough magnetic fields, the Zeeman effect is going to become even more complicated. And this calculation just applies to small magnetic fields. But it turns out that small magnetic fields as viewed by an atom are typically pretty large magnetic fields for the laboratory. So historically, it took a while before people got to the quadratic Zeeman effect, which is also associated with the name passion, who is the same passion who's associated with the transitions in the hydrogen atom. I think that's how you spell passion. Questions? Okay, so Wednesday, I guess we'll be talking about perturbation theory, which is super important. And at least starts out